Zemma had found it difficult to understand a word he said. She assumed he was having the same problem. "I'm looking for a small, inexpensive hotel near Merton Street on Manhattan Island," she said, slowly enunciating each word.
"Merton Street," repeated the driver, as if it was the only thing he'd understood.
"That's right," said Emma.
"Why didn't you say so the first time?"
The driver took off and didn't speak again until he dropped his fare outside a red brick building that flew a flag proclaiming the Mayflower Hotel.
"That'll be 40 cents, said the cabbie, the cigar bobbing up and down with each word.
Emma paid the fare from the wage packet she'd earned while on the ship. Once she'd checked into the hotel, she took the lift to the fourth floor and went straight to her room. The first thing she did was to get undressed and run herself a hot bath. When she reluctantly climbed out, she dried herself with a large, fluffy towel, dressed in what she considered a demure frock, and made her way back down to the ground floor. She felt almost human. Emma found a quiet table in the corner of the hotel coffee shop and ordered a cup of tea. They hadn't heard of Earl Grey, and a club sandwich, something she'd never heard of. While she waited to be served, she began to write out a long list of questions on a paper napkin, hoping there would be someone living at 46 Merton Street who was willing to answer them. Once she'd signed the check, another new word, Emma asked the receptionist for directions to Merton Street. 3 blocks north, 2 blocks west, she was told. She hadn't realized that every New Yorker possessed a built-in compass. Emma enjoyed the walk, stopping several times to admire windows filled with merchandise she had never seen in Bristol. She arrived outside a high-rise apartment block just after midday, unsure what she would do if Mrs. Tibbett wasn't at home. A smartly dressed doorman saluted and opened the door for her.
"Can I help you?"
"I've come to see Mrs. Tibbett," Emma said, trying to sound as if she was expected.
"Apartment 31 on the third floor," he said, touching the rim of his cap.
It was true. An English accent did appear to open doors. As the elevator made its way slowly up to the third floor, Emma rehearsed some lines she hoped would open another door. When the elevator stopped, she pulled back the grill, stepped out into the corridor, and went in search of number 31. There was a tiny circle of glass set in the middle of the Tibbetts' door, which reminded Emma of a cyclops' eye. She couldn't see in, but she assumed the occupants could see out. A more familiar buzzer was on the wall beside the door. She pressed it and waited. It was some time before the door eventually opened, but only a few inches, revealing a brass chain. 2 eyes peered out at her.
"What do you want?"
asked a voice that she could at least understand.
"I'm sorry to bother you, Mrs. Tibbett," said Emma, "but you may be my last chance."
The eyes looked suspicious.
"You see, I'm desperately trying to find Tom."
"Tom?" repeated the voice.
"Tom Bradshaw. He's the father of my child," said Emma, playing her last door-opening card.
The door closed, the chain was removed, and the door opened once again to reveal a young woman carrying a baby in her arms.
"I'm sorry about that," she said, "but Richard doesn't like me opening the door to strangers. Please come in."
She led Emma through to the living room.
"Have a seat while I put Jake back in his cot."
Emma sat down and glanced around the room. There were several photographs of Kristen with a young naval officer who she assumed must be her husband, Richard. Kristen returned a few minutes later carrying a tray of coffee.
"Black or white?"
"White, please," said Emma, who'd never drunk coffee in England, but was quickly learning that Americans don't drink tea, even in the morning.
"Sugar?"
inquired Kristen after she'd poured 2 coffees.
"No, thank you." "So, is Tom your husband?"
asked Kristen as she sat down opposite Emma.
"No, I'm his fiancé. To be fair, he had no idea I was pregnant." "How did you find me?"
asked Kristen, still sounding a little apprehensive.
The purser on the Kansas Star said you and Richard were among the last people to see Tom. That's true. We were with him until he was arrested a few moments after he stepped on shore. Arrested? Said Emma in disbelief. What could he possibly have done to get himself arrested? He was accused of murdering his brother, said Kristen. But surely you knew that. Emma burst into tears, her hopes shattered by the realization that it must have been Bradshaw who'd survived and not Harry. If Harry had been accused of murdering Bradshaw's brother, it would have been so easy for him to prove they'd arrested the wrong man. If only she'd ripped open the letter on Maisie's mantelpiece, she would have discovered the truth and not put herself through this ordeal. She wept, accepting for the first time that Harry was dead.
Giles Barrington, 1939 to 1941. Chapter 11. When Sir Walter Barrington visited his grandson to tell him the terrible news that Harry Clifton had been killed at sea, Giles felt numb, as if he'd lost a limb. In fact, he would have been happy to lose a limb if it would have brought Harry back. The two of them had been inseparable since childhood, and Giles had always assumed they would both score one of life's centuries. Harry's pointless, unnecessary death made Giles even more determined not to make the same mistake himself. Giles was in the drawing room, listening to Mr. Churchill on the radio, when Emma asked, "Do you have any plans to join up?" "Yes, I shan't be returning to Oxford. I intend to sign up immediately." His mother was clearly surprised, but told him that she understood. Emma gave him a huge hug and said, "Harry will be proud of you." Grace, who rarely displayed any emotion, burst into tears. Giles drove into Bristol the following morning and parked his yellow MG ostentatiously outside the front door of the recruiting office. He marched in with what he hoped was resolution written across his face. A sergeant major from the Gloucesters, Captain Jack Tarrant's old regiment, stood smartly to attention the moment he saw young Mr. Barrington. He handed Giles a form, which he dutifully filled in, and an hour later he was invited to step behind a curtain and be examined by an army doctor. The doctor placed a tick in every box after he thoroughly checked this latest recruit: ears, nose, throat, chest and limbs, before finally testing his eyesight. Giles stood behind a white line and recited the letters and numbers on demand. After all, he could dispatch a leather ball coming straight at him at 90 miles an hour to the most distant boundary. He was confident he would pass with flying colours, until the doctor asked him if he was aware of any hereditary ailments or diseases in his family. Giles replied truthfully, "Both my father and grandfather are colourblind." The doctor carried out a further series of tests, and Giles noticed that the ums and ahs turned into tut-tuts. "I'm sorry to have to tell you, Mr. Barrington," he said when he came to the end of his examination, "that given your family's medical history, I will not be able to recommend you for active service. But of course there's nothing to stop you joining up and doing a desk job. Can't you just tick the relevant box, Doctor, and forget I ever raised the damn subject?" said Giles, trying to sound desperate. The doctor ignored his protest, and in the final box on the form he wrote C3, unfit for active service. Giles was back at the manor house in time for lunch. His mother, Elizabeth, didn't comment on the fact that he drank almost a bottle of wine. He told everyone who asked, and several who didn't, that he'd been rejected by the Gloucesters because he suffered from colour blindness. "It didn't stop Grandfather fighting the Boers," Grace reminded him after he'd been served with a second helping of pudding. "They probably had no idea the condition existed back then," said Giles, trying to make light of her barb. Emma followed up with a punch below the belt. "You never intended to sign up in the first place, did you?" she said, looking her brother in the eye. Giles was staring down at his shoes when she delivered the knockout blow. "Pity your friend from the docks isn't here to remind you that he was also colourblind." When Giles's mother heard the news, she was clearly relieved, but didn't comment. Grace didn't speak to her brother again before she returned to Cambridge. Giles drove back to Oxford the following day, trying to convince himself that everyone would accept the reason he'd been unable to sign up, and intended to continue his life as an undergraduate. When he strolled through the college gates, he found that the quad resembled a recruiting centre rather than a university, with young men in uniform outnumbering those wearing subfusc. In Giles' opinion, the only good thing to come out of all this was that for the first time in history, there were as many women as men up at the university. Unfortunately, most of them were only willing to be seen on the arm of someone in uniform. Giles' old school friend, Deakins, was one of the few undergraduates who didn't seem uncomfortable about not signing up. Mind you, there wouldn't have been much point in Deakins taking a medical. It would have been one of the rare exams in which he failed to get a tick in any box. But then he suddenly disappeared, to somewhere called Bletchley Park. No one could tell Giles what they got up to there, except it was all hush-hush. And Deakins warned Giles that he wouldn't be able to visit him at any time, under any circumstances. As the months passed, Giles began to spend more time alone in the pub than in the crowded lecture theatre, while Oxford began to fill up with servicemen returning from the front, some with one arm, others with one leg, a few who were blind, and they were just in his college. He tried to carry on as if he hadn't noticed, but the truth was, by the end of term, he began to feel more and more out of place. Giles drove up to Scotland at the end of term to attend the christening of Sebastian Arthur Clifton. Only the immediate family and one or two close friends were invited to the ceremony that took place in the chapel at Mulgerry Castle. Emma and Giles's father was not among them. Giles was surprised and delighted when Emma asked him to be a godfather, although he was somewhat taken aback when she admitted that the only reason she'd even considered him was that, despite everything, she had no doubt he would have been Harry's first choice. As he was going down to breakfast the following morning, Giles noticed a light coming from his grandfather's study. As he passed the door on his way to the dining room, Giles heard his name come up in conversation. He stopped in his tracks and took a step nearer to the half-open door. He froze in horror when he heard Sir Walter saying,
"It pains me to have to say this, but like father, like son."
"I agree," replied Lord Harvey, "and I'd always thought so highly of the boy, which makes the whole damn business all the more distasteful."
"No one," said Sir Walter, "could have been prouder than I was as chairman of the governors when Giles was appointed head boy of Bristol Grammar School."
"I'd assumed," said Lord Harvey, "that he would put those remarkable talents of leadership and courage he displayed so often on the playing field to good use on the battlefield."
"The only good thing to come out of all this," suggested Sir Walter, "is that I no longer believe that Harry Clifton could possibly be Hugo's son."
Giles strode across the hallway, past the breakfast room and out of the front door. He climbed into his car and began the long journey back to the West Country. The following morning, he parked the car outside a recruiting office. Once again, he stood in line, not for the Gloucesters this time, but on the other side of the Avon, where the Wessex Regiment was signing up new recruits. After he'd filled in the form, he was put through another rigorous medical. This time, when the doctor asked him,
"Are you aware of any hereditary ailments or diseases in your family that might prevent you from carrying out active service?"
he replied, "No, sir." Chapter 12. At noon the following day, Giles left one world and entered another. 36 raw recruits, with nothing in common other than the fact that they had signed up to take the King's Shilling, clambered aboard a train with a corporal acting as their nanny. As the train pulled out of the station, Giles stared through the grimy third-class window and was certain of only one thing: they were heading south. But not until the train shunted into Limpston 4 hours later did he realise just how far south. During the journey, Giles remained silent and listened attentively to all those men around him who would be his companions for the next 12 weeks. A bus driver from Filton, a policeman from Long Ashton, a butcher from Broad Street, a builder from Nailsea, and a farmer from Winscombe. Once they disembarked from the train, the corporal ferried them onto a waiting bus.
Where are we going?
Asked the butcher.
You'll find out soon enough, laddie,
replied the corporal, revealing his birthplace. For an hour the bus trundled across Dartmoor, until there was no sign of houses or people, just the occasional hawk flying overhead in search of prey. They eventually stopped outside a desolate group of buildings, displaying a weathered sign that announced Ypres Barracks, training camp for the Wessex Regiment. It didn't lift Giles's spirits. A soldier marched out of the gatehouse and raised the barrier to allow the bus to continue for another 100 yards before coming to a halt in the middle of a parade ground. A solitary figure stood waiting for them to disembark. When Giles climbed off the bus, he came face to face with a giant of a man, barrel-chested and dressed in a khaki uniform, who looked as if he had been planted on the parade ground. There were 3 rows of medals on his chest and a pace stick under his left arm, but what struck Giles most about him was the knife-edge crease in his trousers and the fact that his boots were so highly polished he could see his reflection in them.
"Good afternoon, gentlemen,"
the man said in a voice that boomed around the parade ground. Not someone who would find any use for a megaphone, thought Giles.
"My name is Sergeant Major Dawson. Sir, to you. It's my responsibility to turn you from a shambolic rabble into a fighting force in just 12 weeks. By then you will be able to call yourselves members of the Wessex, the finest regiment of the line. For the next 12 weeks I will be your mother, your father, and your sweetheart, and let me assure you, I only have one purpose in life, and that is to make sure that when you meet your first German, you'll be able to kill him before he kills you. That process will begin at 5 tomorrow morning."
A groan went up, which the Sergeant Major ignored.
"Until then, I'll leave Corporal MacLeod to take you to the canteen before you settle into your barracks. Be sure to get a good night's rest, because you'll need every ounce of energy you possess when we meet again. Carry on, Corporal."
Giles sat down in front of a fish cake whose ingredients had never seen salt water, and after one sip of lukewarm brown water posing as tea, he put his mug back on the table.
"If you're not going to eat your fish cake, can I have it?"
asked the young man sitting next to him. Giles nodded, and they swapped plates. He didn't speak again until he devoured Giles's offering.
"I know your mum," the man said.
Giles gave him a closer look, wondering how that could be possible.
"We supply the meat for the manor house and Barrington Hall," the man continued. "I like your mum," he said. "Very nice lady. I'm Bates, by the way. Terry Bates."
He shook Giles firmly by the hand.
"Never thought I'd end up sitting next to you."
"Great chaps, let's be having you," said the corporal.
The new recruits leapt up from the benches and followed the corporal out of the canteen and across the parade ground to a Nissen hut with Marn painted on the door. Another Wessex battle honour, the corporal explained before opening the door to reveal their new home. 36 beds, 18 on each side, had been crammed into a space no larger than the dining room at Barrington Hall. Giles had been placed between Atkinson and Bates. Not unlike prep school, he thought, though he did come across one or two differences during the next few days.
"Right, chaps, time to get undressed and have a kip."
Long before the last man had climbed into bed, the corporal switched off the lights and bellowed,
"Make sure you get some shut-eye. You got a busy day ahead of you tomorrow."
It wouldn't have surprised Giles if, like Fisher, his old school prefect, he'd added,
"No talking after lights out."
As promised, the lights came back on at 5 o'clock the following morning. Not that Giles had a chance to look at his watch after Sergeant Major Dawson entered the hut and bellowed,
"Last man with both feet on the ground will be the first to be bayoneted by a kraut."
A large number of feet quickly hit the floor as the Sergeant Major marched down the centre of the hut, his pace stick banging the end of any bed whose incumbent still didn't have both feet on the ground.
"Now listen, and listen carefully," he continued. "I'm going to give you 4 minutes to wash and shave, 4 minutes to make your bed, 4 minutes to get dressed, and 8 minutes to have breakfast. 20 minutes in all. I don't recommend any talking on account of the fact you can't afford to waste the time, and in any case, I'm the only one who's allowed to talk. Is that understood?"
"It most certainly is," said Giles, which was followed by a ripple of surprised laughter.
A moment later, the Sergeant Major was standing in front of him.
"Whenever you open your mouth, sonny," he barked, placing his pace stick on Giles's shoulder, "all I want to hear is yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir. Is that clear?"
"Yes, sir," said Giles.
"I don't think I heard you, sonny."
"Yes, sir," shouted Giles.
"That's better. Now, get yourself in the washroom, you horrible little man, before I put you on jankers."
Giles had no idea what jankers was, but it didn't sound enticing. Bates was already on his way out of the washroom when Giles walked in. By the time he'd shaved, Bates had made his bed, dressed, and was on his way to the canteen. When Giles eventually caught up with him, he took a seat on the bench opposite.
"How do you manage it?"
asked Giles in admiration.
"Manage what?"
asked Bates.
"To be so wide awake, when the rest of us are still half asleep."
"Simple, really. I'm a butcher, like me dad. Up every morning at 4, and off to the market. If I want the best cuts, I have to be waiting for them the moment they're delivered from the docks or the station. Only have to be a few minutes late, and I'm getting second best. Half an hour late, and it's scrag ends. And your mum wouldn't thank me for that, would she?"
Giles laughed as Bates leapt up, and began heading back to the barracks, only to discover that the Sergeant Major hadn't allowed any time for cleaning teeth. Most of the morning was spent fitting up the sprogs, as they were referred to, with uniforms, one or two of which looked as if they'd had a previous owner. Berets, belts, boots, tin hats, blanco, brasso, and boot polish followed. Once they'd been kitted out, the recruits were taken onto the parade ground for their first drill session. Having served, if somewhat inattentively, in the school's combined cadet force, Giles started with a slight advantage, but he had a feeling it wouldn't be too long before Terry Bates caught up with him. At 12, they were marched off to the canteen. Giles was so hungry he ate almost everything on offer. After lunch, they returned to the barracks and changed into their gym kit before being herded across to the gymnasium. Giles silently thanked his prep school PT instructor for having taught him how to climb a rope, how to balance on a beam, and how to use the wall bars for stretching. He couldn't help noticing that Bates shadowed his every move. The afternoon ended with a 5-mile run across the Devon Moors. Only 8 of the 36 raw recruits came back through the barracks gates at the same time as their gym instructor. One even managed to get lost, and a search party had to be sent out to look for him. Tea was followed by what the Sergeant Major described as recreation, which for most of the lads turned out to be collapsing on their bunks and falling into a deep sleep. At 5 the following morning, the door to the barracks flew open once again, and this time several pairs of feet were already on the ground before the Sergeant Major had switched the lights on. Breakfast was followed by another hour of marching on the parade ground, and by now almost everyone was in step. The new recruits then sat in a circle on the grass and learned how to strip, clean, load, and fire a rifle. The corporal pulled a 4x2 through the barrel in one clean movement, reminding them that the bullet doesn't know which side it's on, so give it every chance to leave the barrel from the front and kill the enemy, and not backfire and kill you. The afternoon was spent on the rifle range, where the instructors taught each recruit to nestle the butt of the rifle firmly into their shoulder, line up the foresight and rear sight with the center circle of the target, and squeeze the trigger gently, never snatch at it. This time Giles thanked his grandfather for the hours spent on his grouse moor that ensured he kept hitting the bullseye. The day ended with another 5-mile run, tea and recreation, followed by lights out at 10. Most of the men had collapsed on their beds long before that, wishing the sun would fail to rise the next morning, or at least that the Sergeant Major would die in his sleep. They didn't get lucky. The first week felt like a month to Giles, but by the end of the second, he was beginning to master the routine, although he never once got to the washroom ahead of Bates. Although he didn't enjoy basic training any more than the next man, Giles did relish the challenge of competition. But he had to admit that as each day went by, he was finding it more and more difficult to shake off the butcher from Broad Street. Bates was able to match him punch for punch in the boxing ring, trade bullseyes on the rifle range, and when they started wearing heavy boots and having to carry a rifle on the 5-mile run, the man who for years had been hauling carcasses of beef around on his shoulder morning, noon and night suddenly became a lot harder to beat. At the end of the 6th week, no one was surprised that it was Barrington and Bates who were selected for promotion to Lance Corporal, and each given a section of their own. No sooner had they sewn on their stripes than the two sections they led became deadly rivals, not just on the parade ground or in the gymnasium, but whenever they went out on night ops or were involved in field exercises and troop movements. At the end of each day, like a couple of schoolboys, Giles and Bates would both declare themselves the winner. Often the sergeant major would have to prize them apart. As they approached the day of the passing out parade, Giles could sense the pride in both sections, who'd begun to believe they might just be worthy of calling themselves Wessexians by the time they passed out, although the sergeant major repeatedly warned them that it wouldn't be long before they had to take part in a real battle against a real enemy with real bullets. He also reminded them that he wouldn't be around to hold their hands. For the first time, Giles accepted that he was going to miss the damn man.
"Bring him on,"
was all Bates had to say on the subject. When they finally passed out on the Friday of the 12th week, Giles assumed that he would be returning to Bristol with the other lads to enjoy a weekend's leave before reporting to the regimental depot the following Monday. But when he walked off the parade ground that afternoon, the sergeant major took him to one side.
"Corporal Barrington, you're to report to Major Radcliffe immediately."
Giles would have asked why, but he knew he wouldn't get an answer. He marched across the parade ground and knocked on the office door of the adjutant, a man he'd only ever seen at a distance.
"Enter,"
said a voice. Giles walked in, stood to attention, and saluted.
"Barrington,"
Major Radcliffe said after he'd returned the salute,
"I have some good news for you. You've been accepted for officer training school."
Giles didn't even realize he was being considered for a commission.
"You'll have to travel straight to Mons tomorrow morning, where you will begin an induction course on Monday. Many congratulations and good luck."
"Thank you, sir,"
said Giles, before asking, "Will Bates be joining me?"
"Bates?" said Major Radcliffe. "Do you mean Corporal Bates?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good heavens, no," replied the adjutant. "He's not officer material."
Giles could only hope that the Germans were just as short-sighted when it came to selecting their officers. When Giles reported to the Mons Officer Cadet Training Unit in Aldershot the following afternoon, he was unprepared for how quickly his life would change again. It took him some time to get used to corporals, sergeants, even the sergeant major calling him Sir. He slept in a single room where the door didn't fly open at 5 in the morning, with an NCO banging the end of his bed with a stick, demanding he place both feet on the ground. The door only opened when Giles chose to open it. He had breakfast in the mess with a group of young men who didn't need to be taught how to hold a knife and fork, although one or two of them looked as if they would never learn how to handle a rifle, let alone fire it in anger. But in a few weeks' time, these same men would be in the front line, leading inexperienced volunteers whose lives would depend on their judgment. Giles joined these men in a classroom where they were taught military history, geography, map reading, battle tactics, German, and the art of leadership. If he'd learnt one thing from the butcher from Broad Street, it was that the art of leadership couldn't be taught. 8 weeks later, the same young men stood on a passing out parade and were awarded the King's Commission. They were presented with 2 crowned pips, one for each shoulder, a brown leather officer's cane, and a letter of congratulations from a grateful king. All Giles wanted to do was to rejoin his regiment and team up with his old comrades, but he knew that wouldn't be possible, because when he walked off the parade ground that Friday afternoon, the corporals, the sergeants, and yes, even the sergeant major, saluted him. 60 young second lieutenants left Aldershot that afternoon for every corner of the land, to spend a weekend with their families, some of them for the last time. Giles spent most of Saturday jumping on and off trains as he made his way back to the West Country. He arrived at the manor house just in time to join his mother for dinner. When she first saw the young lieutenant standing in the hallway, Elizabeth made no attempt to hide her pride. Giles was disappointed that neither Emma nor Grace was at home to see him in uniform. His mother explained that Grace, who was in her second term at Cambridge, rarely came home, even during the vacation. Over a one-course meal served by Jenkins, several of the staff were now serving on the front line, not at the dinner table, his mother explained, Giles told his mother about what they got up to in training camp on Dartmoor. When she heard about Terry Bates, she sighed,
"Bates and Son, they used to be the best butchers in Bristol. used to be. Every shop in Broad Street was razed to the ground, so we've been deprived of Bates the butcher. Those Germans have a lot to answer for.
Giles frowned.
And Emma?
He asked.
Couldn't be better. Except...
Except? Repeated Giles. It was some time before his mother quietly added,
How much more convenient it would have been if Emma had produced a daughter rather than a son.
Why is that important? Asked Giles as he refilled his glass. His mother bowed her head, but said nothing.
Oh, God,
said Giles, as the significance of her words sank in.
I had assumed that when Harry died, I would inherit. I'm afraid you can't assume anything, darling, said his mother, looking up. That is, not until it can be established that your father is not also Harry's father. Until then, under the terms of your great-grandfather's will, it will be Sebastian who eventually inherits the title.
Giles hardly spoke again during the meal, while he tried to take in the significance of his mother's words. Once coffee had been served, his mother said she felt tired and went to bed. When Giles climbed the stairs to his room a few moments later, he couldn't resist dropping into the nursery to see his godson. He sat alone with the heir to the Barrington title. Sebastian gurgled in blissful sleep, clearly untroubled by war, and certainly not giving a thought to his grandfather's will, or the significance of the words, and all that therein is. The following day, Giles joined his grandfathers for lunch at the Savage Club. It was a very different atmosphere from the weekend they'd shared 5 months earlier at Mulgerry Castle. The only thing the two old men seemed keen to find out was where his regiment would be posted.
I've no idea, replied Giles, who would like to have known himself.
But he would have given the same response, even if he had been briefed, despite the fact that these two venerable old gentlemen were Boer War veterans. Lieutenant Barrington rose early on the Monday morning and, after breakfast with his mother, was driven by Hudson to the headquarters of the 1st Wessex Regiment. He was held up by a steady stream of armoured vehicles and lorries filled with troops pouring out of the main gate. He got out of the car and walked to the guardhouse.
"Good morning, sir,"
said a corporal, after giving him a crisp salute, something Giles still hadn't got used to.
"The adjutant has requested that you report to his office as soon as you arrive."
"I'd be happy to do so, Corporal," said Giles, returning his salute, "if I knew where Major Ratcliffe's office was."
"Far side of the square, sir, green door, you can't miss it."
Giles marched across the square, returning several more salutes before he reached the adjutant's office. Major Ratcliffe looked up from behind his desk as Giles entered the room.
"Ah, Barrington, old chap, good to see you again," he said. "We weren't certain if you'd make it in time."
"In time for what, sir?" asked Giles.
"The regiment's been posted abroad, and the colonel felt you should be given the opportunity of joining us, or staying behind and waiting for the next shindig."
"Where are we going, sir?"
"Haven't a clue, old chap. Way above my rank. But I can tell you one thing for certain, it will be a damn sight closer to the Germans than Bristol."
Harry Clifton, 1941. Chapter 13. Harry would never forget the day Lloyd was released from Lavenham, and although he wasn't disappointed to see him go, he was surprised by Max's parting words.
"Would you do me a favour, Tom?" Lloyd said as they shook hands for the last time. "I'm enjoying your diaries so much, I'd like to go on reading them." "If you'd send them to this address," he said, handing Harry a card as if he were already on the outside, "I'll return them to you within a week."
Harry was flattered, and agreed to send Max each exercise book once he completed it. The following morning, Harry took his place behind the librarian's desk, but didn't consider reading the previous day's newspaper before he completed his duties. He continued to update his diaries every evening, and whenever he came to the end of a notebook, he would post his latest efforts to Max Lloyd. He was relieved and a little surprised when they were always returned, as promised. As the months passed, Harry began to accept the fact that prison life was mostly routine and mundane. So when the warden charged into the library one morning, brandishing his copy of the New York Times, he was taken by surprise. Harry put down the stack of books he'd been replacing on the shelves.
Do we have a map of the United States? Swanson demanded.
Yes, of course, Harry replied.
He walked quickly over to the reference section and extracted a copy of Hubert's map of America.
Anywhere in particular, Warden?
He asked. Pearl Harbor. For the next 24 hours, there was only one subject on everyone's lips, prisoners and guards alike. When would America enter the war? Swanson returned to the library the following morning.
President Roosevelt has just announced on the radio that the United States has declared war on Japan.
That's all very well, said Harry. But when will the Americans help us defeat Hitler?
Harry regretted the word us the moment he'd uttered it. He looked up to find Swanson staring at him quizzically, and quickly returned to shelving the previous day's books. Harry found out the answer some weeks later, when Winston Churchill boarded the Queen Mary and sailed to Washington to conduct discussions with the President. By the time the Prime Minister had arrived back in Britain, Roosevelt had agreed that the United States would turn their attention to the war in Europe and the task of defeating Nazi Germany. Harry filled page after page of his diary with the reaction of his fellow prisoners to the news that their country was at war. He concluded that most of them fell into one of two distinct categories, the cowards and the heroes. Those who were relieved to be safely locked up in jail and only hoped the hostilities would be over long before they were released, and those who couldn't wait to get out and take on an enemy they hated even more than the prison guards. When Harry asked his cellmate which category he fell into, Quinn replied,
"Have you ever met an Irishman who didn't relish a scrap?"
For his part, Harry became even more frustrated, convinced that now the Americans had entered the war, it would be over long before he'd been given the chance to play his part. For the first time since being locked up, he thought about trying to escape. Harry had just finished reading a book review in the New York Times when an officer marched into the library and said,
"The warden wants to see you in his office immediately, Bradshaw."
Harry wasn't surprised, although after glancing once again at the advertisement at the bottom of the page, he still wondered how Lloyd imagined he would get away with it. He folded the paper neatly, placed it back in the rack, and followed the officer out of the room.
"Any idea why he wants to see me, Mr. Joyce?" Harry asked as they walked across the yard. "Don't ask me," said Joyce, not attempting to hide his sarcasm. "I've never been one of the warden's confidants."
Harry didn't speak again until they were standing outside the warden's office. Joyce gave a quiet tap on the door.
"Enter," said an unmistakable voice.
Joyce opened the door, and Harry walked into the room. He was surprised to find another man he'd never seen before seated opposite the warden. The man was wearing an army officer's uniform and looked as smart as Harry felt unkempt. He never took his eyes off the prisoner. The warden rose from behind his desk.
"Good morning, Tom."
It was the first time Swanson had addressed him by his Christian name.
"This is Colonel Claverton of the 5th Texas Rangers."
"Good morning, sir," said Harry.
Claverton stood up and shook hands with Harry, another first.
"Have a seat, Tom," said Swanson. "The colonel has a proposition he wants to put to you."
Harry sat down.
"It's good to meet you, Bradshaw," began Colonel Claverton as he sat back down. "I'm the commanding officer of Rangers."
Harry gave him a quizzical look.
"You won't find us listed in any recruitment manuals. I train groups of soldiers who will be dropped behind enemy lines with the purpose of causing as much mayhem for the enemy as possible, so the infantry will have a better chance to do their job. Nobody knows yet where or when our troops will be landing in Europe, but I'll be among the first to be told, as my boys will be parachuted into the target area a few days before the invasion."
Harry was sitting on the edge of his seat.
"But before that balloon goes up, I'll be putting together a small specialist unit to prepare for any eventuality. This unit will consist of 3 groups, each comprising 10 men. 1 captain, 1 staff sergeant, 2 corporals, and 6 private soldiers. During the past few weeks, I've been in touch with several prison wardens to ask if they had any exceptional men who they felt might be suited for such an operation. Your name was one of the 2 put forward by Mr. Swanson. Once I check your record from when you served in the Navy, I had to agree with the warden that you'd be better off in uniform rather than wasting your time in here.
Harry turned to the warden.
Thank you, sir, but may I ask who the other person is?
Quinn, said Swanson. The two of you have caused me so many problems during the past couple of years, I thought it was the Germans' turn to be subjected to your special brand of subterfuge.
Harry smiled.
If you decide to join us, Bradshaw, continued the colonel, you'll begin an 8-week basic training course immediately, followed by a further 6 weeks with special operations. Before I go any further, I need to know if the idea appeals to you.
When do I start? Said Harry.
The colonel smiled.
My car's outside in the yard, and I left the engine running.
I've already arranged for your civilian clothes to be collected from the stores, said the warden. Obviously, we need to keep the reason you've left at such short notice between ourselves. Should anyone ask, I'll say you and Quinn have been transferred to another prison.
The colonel nodded.
Any questions, Bradshaw?
Has Quinn agreed to join you?
Asked Harry.
He's sitting in the back seat of my car, probably wondering what's taking you so long.
But you do know the reason I'm in prison, Colonel.
Desertion, said Colonel Cleverdon. So I'll have to keep a close eye on you, won't I?
Both men laughed.
You'll be joining my group as a private soldier, but I can assure you your past record won't hinder your chances of promotion. However, while we're on that subject, Bradshaw, a change of name might be appropriate, given the circumstances. We won't want some smartass in records to get their hands on your Navy files and start asking embarrassing questions. Any ideas?
Harry Clifton, sir, he said a little too quickly.
The warden smiled.
I've always wondered what your real name was.
Emma Barrington, 1941. Chapter 14. Emma wanted to leave Kristen's apartment as soon as possible, escape from New York, and return to England. Once she was back in Bristol, she could grieve alone and devote her life to bringing up Harry's son. But escape wasn't proving to be that easy. I'm so sorry, said Kristen, placing an arm around Emma's shoulders. I had no idea you didn't know what had happened to Tom. Emma smiled weakly. I want you to know, continued Kristen, that Richard and I never doubted even for a moment that he was innocent. The man I nursed back to life wasn't capable of murder. Thank you, said Emma. I have some photographs of Tom while he was with us on the Kansas Star. Would you like to see them? Asked Kristen. Emma nodded politely, although she had no interest in seeing any photographs of Lieutenant Thomas Bradshaw. She decided that once Kristen had left the room, she would quietly slip out of the apartment and return to her hotel. She had no desire to continue making such a fool of herself in front of a complete stranger. As soon as Kristen went out, Emma jumped up. As she did so, she knocked her cup off the table and onto the floor, spilling some coffee on the carpet. She fell to her knees and began weeping again, just as Kristen came back into the room, clutching a handful of photographs. When she saw Emma on her knees in tears, she tried to comfort her. Please don't worry about the carpet. It's not important. Here, why don't you take a look at these while I find something to clear it up? She handed the photographs to Emma and quickly left the room again. Emma accepted she could no longer make good her escape, so she returned to her chair and reluctantly began to look at the photos of Tom Bradshaw. Oh, my God, she said out loud. She stared in disbelief at a picture of Harry standing on the deck of a ship with the Statue of Liberty in the background, and then at another with the skyscrapers of Manhattan as the backdrop. Tears came to her eyes once again, even if she was unable to explain how it was possible. She waited impatiently for Kristen to return. It wasn't long before the conscientious housewife reappeared, knelt down, and began to remove the small brown stain with a damp cloth. "Do you know what happened to Tom after he was arrested?" Emma asked anxiously. "Didn't anyone tell you?" asked Kristen, looking up. "Apparently there wasn't enough evidence to try him for murder,
and Jelks got him off. He was charged with desertion from the Navy, pleaded guilty, and was sentenced to 6 years. Emma just didn't understand how Harry could have ended up in jail for a crime he obviously hadn't committed. Did the trial take place in New York? Yes, Kristen replied. As his lawyer was Sefton Jelks, Richard and I assumed he wasn't in need of any financial help. I'm not sure I understand. Sefton Jelks is the senior partner of one of New York's most prestigious law practices, so at least Tom was being well represented. When he came to see us about Tom, he seemed genuinely concerned. I know he also visited Dr. Wallace and the ship's captain, and he assured all of us that Tom was innocent. Do you know which prison they sent him to? Emma asked quietly. Lavenham, in upstate New York. Richard and I tried to visit him, but Mr. Jelks told us he didn't want to see anyone. You've been so kind, said Emma. Perhaps I can ask one more small favor before I leave. May I be allowed to keep one of these photographs? Keep them all. Richard took dozens. He always does. Photography is his hobby. I don't want to waste any more of your time, said Emma, rising unsteadily to her feet. Oh, you're not wasting my time, Kristen replied. What happened to Tom never made sense to either of us. When you see him, please pass on our best wishes, she said as they walked out of the room. And if he'd like us to visit him, we'd be happy to. Thank you, said Emma, as the chain was removed once again. As Kristen opened the door, she said, We both realized Tom was desperately in love, but he didn't tell us you were English. Chapter 15 Emma switched on the bedside light and once again studied the photographs of Harry standing on the deck of the Kansas Star. He looked so happy, so relaxed, and clearly unaware what awaited him when he stepped ashore. She drifted in and out of sleep as she tried to work out why Harry would be willing to face a murder trial and would plead guilty to desertion from a Navy he'd never signed up for. She concluded that only Sefton Jelks could provide the answers. The first thing she needed to do was make an appointment to see him. She glanced again at the bedside clock. 3:21. She got out of bed, put on a dressing gown, sat down at the little table, and filled several sheets of hotel stationery with notes in preparation for her meeting with Sefton Jelks. It felt like prepping for an exam. At 6, she showered and dressed, then went downstairs to breakfast. A copy of the New York Times had been left on her table, and she quickly turned the pages, only stopping to read one article. The Americans were becoming pessimistic about Britain being able to survive a German invasion, which was looking increasingly likely. Above a photograph of Winston Churchill standing on the white cliffs of Dover, staring defiantly out across the channel, his trademark cigar in place, was the headline, "We will fight them on the beaches." Emma felt guilty about being away from her homeland. She must find Harry, get him released from prison, and together they would return to Bristol. The hotel receptionist looked up Jelks, Myers and Abernathy in the Manhattan telephone directory, wrote out an address on Wall Street, and handed it to Emma. The cab dropped her outside a vast steel and glass building that stretched high into the sky. She pushed through the revolving doors and checked a large board on the wall that listed the names of every firm on the 48 floors. Jelks, Myers and Abernathy was located on floors 20, 21 and 22, all inquiries at reception on the 20th floor. Emma joined a horde of grey flannel-suited men who filled the first available elevator. When she stepped out on the 20th floor, she was greeted by the sight of three smart women dressed in open-neck white blouses and black skirts who sat behind a reception desk, something else she hadn't seen in Bristol. She marched confidently up to the desk. I'd like to see Mr. Jelks. Do you have an appointment? The receptionist asked politely. No, admitted Emma, who'd only ever dealt with a local solicitor who was always available whenever a member of the Barrington family dropped in. The receptionist looked surprised. Clients didn't just turn up at the front desk hoping to see the senior partner. They either wrote or their secretary phoned to make an appointment in Mr. Jelks's crowded diary. "If I could take your name, I'll have a word with his assistant." Emma Barrington. "Please have a seat, Miss Barrington. Someone will be with you shortly." Emma sat alone in a little alcove. Shortly turned out to be more than half an hour, when another grey-suited man appeared, carrying a yellow pad.
"My name is Samuel Anscott," he said, offering his hand. "I understand that you wish to see the senior partner."
"That is correct."
"I'm his legal assistant," said Anscott as he took the seat opposite her. "Mr. Jelks has asked me to find out why you want to see him."
"It's a private matter," said Emma.
"I'm afraid he won't agree to see you unless I'm able to tell him what it's about."
Emma pursed her lips. "I'm a friend of Harry Clifton." She watched Anscott closely, but it was obvious that the name meant nothing to him, although he did make a note of it on his yellow pad. "I have reason to believe that Harry Clifton was arrested for the murder of Adam Bradshaw and that Mr. Jelks represented him." This time the name did register, and the pen moved more swiftly across the pad. "I wish to see Mr. Jelks in order to find out how a lawyer of his standing could have allowed my fiancé to take Thomas Bradshaw's place." A deep frown appeared on the young man's face. He clearly wasn't used to anyone referring to his boss in this way.
"I have no idea what you're talking about, Miss Barrington," he said, which Emma suspected was true. "But I will brief Mr. Jelks and come back to you. Perhaps you could give me a contact address."
"I'm staying at the Mayflower Hotel," said Emma, "and I'm available to see Mr. Jelks at any time." Anscott made another note on his pad, stood up, gave a curt nod, but this time didn't offer to shake hands. Emma felt confident that she wouldn't have to wait long before the senior partner agreed to see her. She took a taxi back to the Mayflower Hotel and could hear the phone ringing in her room even before she'd opened the door. She ran across the room, but by the time she picked up the receiver, the line had gone dead. She sat down at the desk and began to write to her mother to say she'd arrived safely, although she didn't mention the fact that she was now convinced Harry was alive. Emma would only do that when she'd seen him in the flesh. She was on the third page of the letter when the phone rang again. She picked it up.
"Good afternoon, Miss Barrington."
"Good afternoon, Mr. Anscott," she said, not needing to be told who it was.
"I've spoken to Mr. Jelks concerning your request for a meeting, but I'm afraid he's unable to see you because it would create a conflict of interest with another client he represents. He is sorry not to be more helpful."
The line went dead. Emma remained at the desk, stunned, still clutching the phone, the words "conflict of interest" ringing in her ears. Was there really another client, and, if so, who could it be? Or was that just an excuse not to see her? She placed the receiver back in its cradle and sat still for some time, wondering what her grandfather would have done in these circumstances. She recalled one of his favourite maxims: "There's more than one way to skin a cat." Emma opened the desk drawer, thankful to find a fresh supply of stationery, and made a list of people who might be able to fill in some of the gaps created by Mr. Jelks's supposed conflict of interest. She then went downstairs to reception, knowing that she was going to be fully occupied for the next few days. The receptionist tried to hide her surprise when the softly spoken young lady from England asked for the address of a courthouse, a police station, and a prison. Before she left the Mayflower, Emma dropped into the hotel's shop and purchased a yellow pad of her own. She walked out onto the pavement and hailed another cab. It dropped her in a very different part of town to the one Mr. Jelks inhabited. As she climbed the courthouse steps, Emma thought about Harry and how he must have felt when he'd entered that same building in very different circumstances. She asked the guard on the door where the reference library was, in the hope of finding out what those circumstances were.
"If you mean the records room, miss, it's in the basement," the guard said.
After walking down two flights of stairs, Emma asked a clerk behind the counter if she could see the records for the case of the State of New York versus Bradshaw. The clerk handed her a form to fill in, which included the question, "Are you a student?" to which she answered, "Yes." A few minutes later, Emma was handed three large box files.
"We close in a couple of hours," she was warned. "When the bell goes, you must return the records to this desk immediately."
Once Emma had read a few pages of documents, she couldn't understand why the state hadn't proceeded with Tom Bradshaw's trial for murder when they seemed to have such a strong case against him. The brothers had been sharing a hotel room. The whiskey decanter had Tom's bloody fingerprints all over it, and there was no suggestion anyone else had entered the room before Adam's body had been found lying in a pool of blood. But worse, why had Tom fled the scene of the crime, and why had the state attorney settled for a guilty plea on the lesser charge of desertion? Even more puzzling was how Harry had ever become involved in the first place. Might the letter on Maisie's mantelpiece contain the answers to all these questions? Or was it simply that Jelks knew something he didn't want her to find out? Her thoughts were interrupted by a clanging bell, demanding that she return the files to the desk. Some questions had been answered, but far more remained unanswered. Emma made a note of two names she hoped could supply most of those answers, but would they also claim a conflict of interest? She emerged from the courthouse just after five, clutching several more sheets of paper covered in her neat long hand. She grabbed something called a Hershey bar and a Coke from a street vendor before she hailed another cab and asked the driver to take her to the 24th Precinct Police Station. She ate and drank on the move, something her mother would never have approved of. On arrival at the police station, Emma asked to speak to either Detective Kalowski or Detective Ryan.
"They're both on nights this week," she was told by the desk sergeant, "so won't be back on duty until 10.
Emma thanked him and decided to return to the hotel and have supper before going back to the 24th precinct at 10. After a Caesar salad and her first Knickerbocker Glory, Emma returned to her room on the fourth floor. She lay down on the bed and thought about what she needed to ask Kalowski or Ryan, assuming either of them agreed to see her. Did Lieutenant Bradshaw have an American accent? Emma fell into a deep sleep, to be jolted back to consciousness by the unfamiliar sound of a police siren blaring from the street below. Now she understood why the rooms on the upper floors were more expensive. She checked her watch. It was 1:15. Damn! She cursed as she leapt off the bed, ran to the bathroom, soaked a flannel under the cold tap, and covered her face. She quickly left the room and took the lift to the ground floor. When she stepped out of the hotel, she was surprised to find the street was just as busy and the pavement every bit as crowded as it had been at midday. She hailed another cab and asked the driver to take her back to the 24th precinct. The New York cabbies were beginning to understand her. Or was she beginning to understand them? She climbed the steps to the police station a few minutes before 2. Another desk sergeant asked her to take a seat and promised to let Kalowski or Ryan know she was waiting in reception. Emma settled down for a long wait. But to her surprise, a couple of minutes later, she heard the desk sergeant say,
"Hey, Carl, there's some lady sitting over there who says she wants to see you."
He gestured in Emma's direction. Detective Kalowski, a coffee in one hand, a cigarette in the other, walked across and gave Emma a half smile. She wondered how quickly that smile would disappear when he discovered why she wanted to see him.
"How can I help you, ma'am?" he asked.
"My name is Emma Barrington," she said, exaggerating her English accent, "and I need to seek your advice on a private matter."
"Then let's go to my office, Miss Barrington,"
Kalowski said, and began to walk down a corridor until he came to a door which he kicked open with the heel of his shoe.
"Have a seat," he said, pointing to the only other chair in the room. "Can I get you a coffee?"
he asked as Emma sat down. No, thank you.
A wise decision, ma'am, he said as he placed his mug on the table, lit his cigarette and sat down. So, how can I help?
I understand that you were one of the detectives who arrested my fiancé.
What's his name?
Thomas Bradshaw. She was right. The look, the voice, the demeanor, everything about him changed.
Yes, I was, and I can tell you, ma'am, it was an open and shut case until Sefton Jelks became involved.
But the case never came to trial, Emma reminded him.
Only because Bradshaw had Jelks as his lawyer. If that guy had defended Pontius Pilate, he would have convinced the jury he was simply assisting a young carpenter who wanted to buy some nails for a cross he was working on.